Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. We frequently have authors on this program because members of our faculty, both current and retired faculty, are very prolific in writing both fiction and nonfiction books. And trying her hand at fiction for the first time is our guest today, Dr. June Hall McCash. She's already published three nonfiction books about Jekyll Island, which all were published by the University of Georgia Press, and she has published three books about the Middle Ages. She lives here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. She was a professor here at MTSU, and she is the founding mother of the University Honors Program, of which she can be justifiably proud because it is still going strong in a brand spanking new building that is designed to promote a sense of intellectual community, I should say. Dr. McCash has written her first novel, Almost to Eden, and it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you, Jenna. It's a delight to be here.
Almost to Eden is about a young woman who comes over here from Ireland and is in search of the American dream, or at least what she perceives to be the American dream. And not unlike a lot of people who land at Ellis Island or landed at Ellis Island in the around the turn of the century, she finds out that the streets are not paved with gold and that there is a lot of hustle and bustle and hard struggle to make it in America. But the adventure that she finds from there and how she finds herself going to Jekyll Island, Georgia, of all places, and the romances that complicate all of this, make for a very intriguing read that has been compared to The Thorn Birds and Upstairs Downstairs. Talk to me, first of all, of where you got the idea for this. You've written about Jekyll Island before in a nonfiction sense. What is your fascination with Jekyll Island as a sense of place? I mean, sense of place is supposed to be very important to Southern writers.
That's correct. And I think it is important. I think it's important to all writers, not just Southern writers. But, of course, Southern writers tend to be identified more with a sense of place than other writers of other regions. Jekyll Island is a place I fell in love with in 1983. My late husband and I were looking for a place to possibly buy a house on the coast because we both loved the seashore so much. And we first went to Jekyll Island, and it was okay, but we didn't discover the historic district that particular visit. But there's an old saying that once you get the sand of Jekyll Island in your shoes, you'll always come back. And for some reason we did come back, and that time we did discover the historic district, and we drove around seeing houses that said Rockefeller House, Goodyear House, and those names, you know, we looked at the original club. It was the Jekyll Island Club that was founded in 1886 by a group of millionaires. And when we looked at the original club membership list, it included names like J.P. Morgan and Joseph Pulitzer and William Rockefeller and W.K. Vanderbilt. And my husband, Bart McCash, who later became chair of the history department here at MTSU, said, well, we need to find something to read. And I totally agreed. So we looked around, but there were no books. And so he said, well, let's just write one. And the first book that we did about Jekyll Island, we wrote together. It was published in 1989, and he passed away in 1991. So the other two I did completely on my own. But what was the impetus for this particular book was a little graveyard at the Jekyll Island on Jekyll Island, at the north end of Jekyll Island. It's the so-called Dubinion Cemetery. And the Dubinions were a group of people who had arrived on the island in 1792, French people who were trying to escape the dangers and the losses that many people were incurring as part of the French Revolution. And it's a long story, and I won't go into all that, but eventually, in 1792, they came to Jekyll Island, and by 1800, they owned the entire island. And they had buried several of their family members there in that little cemetery at the north end. But when I went into that little cemetery for the first time, there were two little graves at the back. and the names of the people were there, and the dates they died, and where they came from. But no one seemed to know anything about them, who they were, and so being a totally inquisitive type, I had to find out, and it didn't take very long to discover who they were. They were both waiters of the Jekyll Island Club. They had died on the same day, and they had drowned, and one was from England, from Liverpool, England, and the other was from Smyrna, which is now Izmir in Turkey. This young man from Turkey died when he was 23 years old. It was Ottoman Empire at the time, of course.
Right.
But he was 23 years old, and I just had to give him a life. And so that's what got me started in terms of thinking about this book.
And you integrated both of these real-life people into the book, as well as some other real-life people in and amongst the fictional characters who were totally
Absolutely.
Of your own making.
Absolutely. Many of the characters are historical figures, who were either members or workers at the Jekyll Island Club. And I've been very interested in the fact that they brought down their seasonal workers from New York, and most of them were immigrants.
Right.
And this population of immigrants has particularly interested me for a long time, not because my family came at that particular time, because my ancestors from Georgia, as a matter of fact, came in the 1700s, but I was very interested in why these people would come, who they were, how they mingled together, and I tried to work all that into the book.
You were, the names you mentioned earlier, the Vanderbilts, Pulitzer, and so forth, these are all very much Gilded Age names.
Absolutely.
Who operated in a very rarefied air, and so Jekyll Island was sort of the southern resort version of Newport, right? This is where the elite would meet to get some sun, and it really was Newport South.
When the club was founded, the New York Times reported that it was the creme de la creme of all, and it was Newport South, except in one way, and that was that they adopted there a philosophy of simplicity. Whereas at Newport, if you visit some of the so-called cottages at Newport, you find them to be rather palatial. Mm-hmm. At Jekyll Island, they are grand, but not palatial in that same way. Many of them are shingle-style cottages, Queen Anne cottages. There was one that was built that actually was rather grand. It had 17 bathrooms and is called Crane Cottage. And when that particular cottage was built, the owner was criticized by some of the club members for being too grandiose.
Mm-hmm.
That just didn't sit very well at Jekyll Island. They came there to enjoy the natural atmosphere, the beautiful island, the healthy climate, and they came from January to April, from Christmas to Easter was the Jekyll Island Club season. And they came to escape the snow and the ice in New York and Chicago primarily, although there were people from other areas. Most of the members were from those two elite groups in New York and Chicago.
The young woman who is the main character in the book, Maggie, arrives at Ellis Island, manages with some difficulty to get to her relative's house, and then comes to find out that because one of them is going to get married and move to Missouri, that she's more or less on her own, and she doesn't know anybody else in New York.
That's right.
So how does she get from the big city all the way down to Jekyll Island?
Well, that's a good question. She was a very lucky lady. In many respects, she tried and tried to find a job in New York, but she had no references. So her little cousin, Kate, had worked at the Jekyll Island Club for several years, but she was the one who's getting married, and she wasn't going to go back. And so Maggie had arrived not too long before they start interviewing people for the club season, and she insisted on taking Maggie for an interview at the Jekyll Island Club, although she was her only reference. But she was such a good worker that they agreed to hire her anyway. And Maggie wasn't sure what she was getting into. She'd heard all these marvelous stories about Jekyll Island, but it was only a job for 3 months, and she really needed something full-time. And she didn't know the degree to which Jekyll Island was going to change her life and make its way into her heart,
mm-hmm.
as it did in mine, I might say.
Yes. tell me something about one of the themes of books that are written about this particular period, even movies that are made about, you know, the Titanic going down. All the movies I've ever seen about the Titanic going down, which happened in this same general period, focus on the theme of socioeconomic class. And that is a prominent theme in your book. And when I read about it, I thought that with the exception of the slavery, what was going on at Jekyll Island at that time was somewhat analogous to the old plantation pre-Civil War South. Yes or no? Agree or disagree?
Well, I disagree, because I think that there is definitely a hierarchy among the elite and a hierarchy among the immigrant workers. And the year-round workers, or the workers who were local, were mostly African-American laborers. And they, too, had their own hierarchy within their own structure.
The field hands and manor workers.
In a sense. They worked with the grounds and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But many of them were very, very well-trusted and much-admired workers. And I have the photographs from all those levels of society and all those different hierarchies within the system. So I think it was quite different from the plantation system, in that people had no choice about where they worked and what they did. In this book, it's very much a question of choice. People can leave or stay. And I think that's an important distinction, even among the former slaves and the freedmen during the period of time in the late 1800s during Reconstruction. That was an important aspect of their lives. They knew they could leave if things weren't going their way, or if things weren't satisfactory to them. And I think that was a really big change and an important aspect of their lives.
Whether you wanted to leave or not, just the fact of knowing that you could.
Exactly.
That you had an option. How did Maggie fit into the Jekyll Island environment?
Maggie, first of all, started out as a chambermaid. She cleaned rooms and emptied chamber pots and did the sorts of things that chambermaids did in those days. Eventually, she would land a job in New York with a member of the Jekyll Island Club family, Francis Baker, who is a real person as well. And all the things that happened to Francis Baker are actually historical facts. She comes back the second time, not as a chambermaid, but as a kind of, well, she's still a maid, but she takes over because one of the personal maids of Mrs. Baker can't come because her mother's ill, so Maggie takes over as her personal maid, who chooses Mrs. Baker's clothes in the morning and the jewelry she wears, or helps her select those things, and is kind of at her beck and call. She brings up her breakfast, and she's working for one person as opposed to the five or six rooms she might have worked at the Jekyll Island Club.
And then Maggie falls in love.
Yes, she does.
And
very deeply in love.
Mm-hmm. And this really affects the rest of her life.
It's a very brief love, but it's a very profound love, and it does affect the rest of her life. You're right.
Yeah. And how does this pertain to the difference in economic classes that are part of the Jekyll Island structure?
Well, if you're asking me, and I think you are, is her beloved member of that social class, that upper social class? The answer is no. He's another immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
He is a waiter at the Jekyll Island Club. In fact, he's Mrs. J.P. Morgan's personal waiter, which is historically accurate. He was. And Maggie finds her way into that other society in a very, I hate to give away too much of the plot, but in a very unusual way. And the rest of the story involves Maggie's loss and struggle to find her son again. She has a son. She loses her son in a very unfair and unjust way. And the book really becomes a story of mother and son in its latter part, and how they lose each other and how they find each other again, not in any way you might expect, however.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult and I think very poignant story.
In writing this book, did you come to experience a sense of nostalgia for the era, or was it more of a closeness to the characters themselves?
Oh, that's a difficult question, because I think both is the answer is yes to both of those questions. I certainly feel I wouldn't want to go back and live in that era for many, many reasons. I couldn't have my computer, and I wouldn't have access to the kind of health care we have today and that sort of thing.
However, and you wouldn't have equal rights as a woman.
I wouldn't have equal rights as a woman. There are many things I would not want to go back to in that era. And yet the women at that club managed to become officers in the club before it was over. There were certainly women who were who profoundly affected the way the club evolved and was run. That was true with the workers as well. But I came to have a real sense of identification with Maggie. You know, I feel like I'm someone who has loved profoundly and lost in a different ways. I feel that Maggie is in part someone I identify with, but at the same time, I think the era was very gracious, but it was built on the backs of poorer people, and it's like the Southern plantation system. I mean, I can see how if you were white, upper middle class, you would think that was just the most gracious kind of life ever. But if you happen to be part of the slave group or the immigrant group coming into America, it's a very different kind of story. And so I don't think I could happily live in that particular environment. I'm glad I don't.
Could you identify in any way with her, the sense in which she felt like a fish out of water, especially after just arriving in America?
Well, there's an organization called the Hibernian Society, and it still exists. In fact, in Savannah every year, at St. Patrick's Day, the Hibernians celebrate the event. But they helped new settlers, new arrivals in America. They tried to help them find jobs and kind of get their legs. So the Irish were very organized in that regard, and they quickly took over certain aspects of political life in New York and that sort of thing. Maggie, because she's a woman and because she feels as though she has no real recourse other than to take this job, I think quickly blends in very nicely with the other workers who go there. There's a definite community. The workers have their own social life. They have dances. They have oyster roasts on the beach and that sort of thing, as they in fact did. And they were allowed many privileges when they were not working and when the millionaires weren't using the beach or whatever, they were certainly welcome there. In fact, I know one instance where she was actually a tutor for the children. She wasn't a chambermaid, but she played golf with the family and she went to tea at some of the millionaires' homes, and she blended in quite well. She certainly was from basically the same social class as Maggie, though she perhaps had a better education.
Did the elite of this era in Jekyll Island come to think of some of their closest servants as members of the family? Did they develop any sort of an emotional feeling for them, or was it still very much an employer-employee relationship?
Well, I think at that time it was still an employer-employee relationship. Although when you live intimately with someone for many, many years, you can't help but develop a fondness and a special relationship with those people. I think that was also true in the era of slavery with some of the house servants who were there often. Not with all, certainly. Not with with most, I would say, but certainly that did happen, in which families simply loved their servants. And I think that was true to some degree in this period of time. Mrs. Baker, for example, was certainly closer to some of her servants than others. You will encounter another character in this book who is far less, he's from that same social class, but he's far less involved in his servants' life. In fact, he treats them more like slaves than anything else. And it's one of the important, I think, comparisons one can make among the characters in this book. They're not all alike.
Right.
They're not simplistic characters at all.
Right. You cannot paint with a broad brush all the members of one class and all the members
Absolutely
of another
not.
Class. They're not
Never.
Monolithic.
Never. And even today, I mean, you can't do that. It's just people are people, and no matter what their color, their religion, their race, their educational background, they're all different. And I think we have to approach each other as individuals and operate from that stance.
At a time when some shopkeepers were putting "No Irish Need Apply" signs in the windows, the upper crust hired Maggie in Jekyll Island, and Maggie is Irish. Apparently her nationality did not matter to them?
Well, you know, I think that people who would put "Irish Need Not Apply" signs in their window already are showing a certain ignorance on their own part. Mm-hmm. Just as in the Jim Crow era, we encountered those kinds of things in the South. I think people of that class, of that really elite class, tended to be far more liberal, far more open, far more accepting of diversity than some of the people who were not so high up in society. You know, oftentimes you have to have somebody that you can be better than.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I think that's...
In order for you to feel good about yourself.
Exactly. And I think many people who don't always feel good about themselves need somebody that they can lord it over, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And this was not a crowd that needed to do that. They were at the apex of society.
So there was no need for them to attempt to make somebody else feel bad in order for them to feel good.
No.
They were already there.
They were there. Mm-hmm. That's right. They were there.
What about the romantic aspects of the book? Was it more enjoyable for you to write the romance than it was to get the history right? Or, you know, are you balancing your academic and your romantic sides of yourself as an author like a yin and yang here?
Well, first of all, let me clarify that the book is not a romance in the generic sense of the word.
No, it's not a romance novel, but it has elements of romance in it.
It does. It has a love relationship, certainly. But I guess I can't really separate the two because the history is so much a part of my background now. I know that history probably better than anybody else on Earth at this juncture. And it just is such a part of the natural flow. The relationships among the people are what interests me. And I think it's one reason I wanted to turn to fiction. We have lots of information about that higher class of people. And we have a good deal of information about the immigrants as well, but not that kind of personal information. When I saw Hector's grave there, I thought, I have to make this young man live. Now, how would he have lived? These two young people come from very different backgrounds. She's Irish. He's Turkish. She is Catholic. He is Greek Orthodox. He's Greek. He's not really Turkish, but he's part of a Greek minority who lives in Turkey. And he's very he very much wants to cling to that Greek heritage that he has. But they lived as a minority in that country. And I think it's the human aspects of these people that just interests me so much in terms of getting their story told. But their story could not, I think, have taken place in a later context.
Right.
I mean, it would have been very, it could have taken place, I suppose, but it would have been a very different kind of story than what we have here. Maggie has also a supporter from the upper class, someone who helps her. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you should have brought up the Titanic, and I won't tell you how it's connected to my story, but the sinking of the Titanic does play an important role in this book as well.
In the story of the Titanic, the unsinkable Molly Brown, who came from nothing and married into to wealth, is seen as sort of a transitional figure between the upper crust who are on the top deck and the poor immigrant folk who are down in steerage.
She was.
And that makes that whole story interesting.
She's quite a character, too. She was an amazing woman, I think, in many respects. But Molly Brown does not play a role in my book. What the book takes us through that early era through World War I, through World War II, and into the post-World War II period. It doesn't end until 1969. And the scene I describe at the end is based in large measure on my first visit to Jekyll Island. Mm-hmm. It was very much still like that when I went there in 1983. And the club had been closed when I went there. It had been closed for more than 20 years. They were thinking about, well, shall we tear it down or what do we do with it? And two young Brunswick architects decided that they were going to try to restore it. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely magnificent today. And if you've never been to Jekyll Island, I heartily recommend a trip there.
Is it owned by the state now?
It's still owned by it's owned by the state of Georgia, which bought the island in 1947, actually by right of eminent domain, but they bought it for $675,000.
So that's a steal.
The entire island with all the improvements. So it was a steal, yes. But it was very controversial then. It's been controversial always, but it's still owned by the state of Georgia. And the Jekyll Island Club is leased to a group of very careful managers who are very interested in maintaining the atmosphere it would have had in its heyday. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful. It's beautifully done. You can go there and play croquet. You can play tennis. You can play golf. You can do all of those things. You can dine in Crane Cottage, the house with 17 bathrooms. And it's quite elegant and lovely.
Can you live there in private residence? Since it's owned by the state, that's not allowed?
We have a private residence there. It's not one of the historic houses, of course, mm-hmm. but it's one of the houses that was built in the 1960s, and the land is leased to us. We own the house, but we lease the land.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just as the Jekyll Island Club members did, right. I might add. They owned their homes, but the land was leased from the club.
When you mentioned wanting to know more about the people who were buried in the cemetery and when you were talking about the difference between being a historian and being emphasizing the romantic part of the novel, you hope you wouldn't find me sexist by saying that I find more concern on the part every time I've talked to a woman who is an historian. She has come from that place. You can see it in Doris Kearns Goodwin every time she talks on television. Mm-hmm. It's not that they are any less concerned with getting things right on the academic side of the equation, mm-hmm. but what spurs them to get started is their desire to make a connection with the people and to understand
exactly.
history through the people's eyes and through their hearts and through their minds.
Exactly. And I think that's how you make history come alive. I have written nonfiction, and I loved doing what I did. I'm glad I did it before I wrote this book, because now I can rest assured that the historical details are accurate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that I've done lots of research on lots of the aspects of the book, but when I read a book of historical fiction, I don't want to read something that I know could not have happened or didn't happen.
You don't want the fiction to run so far afield
exactly.
of reality that it's impossible to imagine it ever having happened
exactly.
in that era.
Exactly. And even though I have some of the characters in the book are fictional, nevertheless, the things that happened to those characters have happened to real people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were far more likely to happen in this era than at a later time, although I understand there were some interesting cases recently in which there's some similar events. And again, I don't want to tell the whole story, mm-hmm. but the mother and son aspect of the relationship that's so so painful, I think, for Maggie to live through. There have been some recent cases that have been very similar. And I do mention one case in here that involves a situation in Tennessee, the case in which I talk about the Judge Tanner in Memphis, and she was running a child, was not exactly a kidnapping ring, but they would take a child from a mother without cause and then make make the cause later.
There was a made-for-TV movie about this very subject.
Yes, there was. There was. And there's a case in my book that involves that particular instance. And the mother gets, well, I won't tell you, but she does get the child back, actually. So you don't have to worry about that. But it plays an important role in Maggie's life, too, in a rather bizarre way.
The book is called Almost to Eden by June Hall McCash. It's published by Twin Oaks Press, and it is worth your while. It is worth your while. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr.
Thank
McCash.
Thank you so much, Jenna.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.